I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode. Welcome back to the Distribution by Juniper Square. I am your host, Brandon Sedloff, and today I'm sitting down with Bob Hart, Chairman and CEO of True America Multifamily. On this episode, we talk about Bob's incredible career in real estate, multifamily market fundamentals, and Bob's flood the zone approach to asset management. You're going to love this episode. Let's get into it. Bob, welcome to the show.
Brandon, great to be here and good to see you.
I like to have all my guests start by introducing themselves. So can you spend a few minutes just maybe kind of introducing yourself, your firm, and then we'll kind of spend a few minutes getting to know you and the early part of your career.
Well, first I have to tell everybody I'm a very proud client of Juniper Square. It's a great company and has a great product. So I'll start out with that.
Thank you.
But, you know, I am the founder and CEO of True America Multifamily, which I formed in June of 13. So that's my current role.
What led you to start True America? What were you doing prior to that?
So I've had a progressive career in real estate and in business. I started a career over four decades ago as a newly minted engineer in the 1980s. And moved to Los Angeles for that career and spent a couple of years working in commercial air conditioning sales. And after that, I decided I wanted to go into other fields, and I went and got an MBA at the Anderson School at UCLA. And that's where I started to become more interested in real estate in Los Angeles and try to figure out a pathway into it. Real estate then wasn't as clear a pathway. Academically, there weren't real estate programs per se, and people typically entered the field either as an entrepreneur, maybe as they were managing real estate, or even as an attorney. So for me, I started out as a small entrepreneur several years after I got out of business school by acquiring my first piece of real estate in Venice, California, and something that I did on my own, raised the money and had a little help in figuring out how to put a small real estate deal together. And then it really mushroomed from there over the remaining 37 years and progressively learning more, acquiring more, and going through cycles. And then really converting my professional career from just being a small investor into working professionally in the field of real estate.
So what was it that led you to want to buy the building in Venice? I always find it fascinating when people have an affinity for real estate. And as you mentioned, it wasn't a well-traveled career path at that stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always had an entrepreneurial bent or wanted to be an owner of something. And I like the housing area. I grew up in an apartment. So I identified with that, and I saw an opportunity to really to build something both for myself and my family, and and to maybe do some good in society by being an ethical and responsible owner of rental housing.
So when you first bought your property in Venice, kind of what did the path look like? Was it an apartment building? Was it a single family? And then kind of what came next? How did that kind of trajectory evolve?
Well, like a lot of apartment entrepreneurs, I mean, I started very small with a duplex, and it just happened to be in a neighborhood that I could afford it in. I could manage it myself and so forth. So as I still do today, I cobble capital together. So I cobbled together some debt. I borrowed some money from a few friends. I put some of my own money in and basically made the deal and ran it for several years. And I was fortunate enough to ride an upward trajectory in the market and sold it for a fairly material profit then, and was able to roll that profit into several other properties. So it was kind of a compounding effect through that very first acquisition.
So at what point did you decide, you mentioned that you kind of became more of a professional investor over time. When did that happen in the journey, and kind of what did that look like? Did you do it on your own? Did you work for another organization?
For about 7 years, from the mid-80s, 86 to 93, I had been investing for my own account, but I wasn't working in real estate and building a fairly substantial small building residential portfolio, along with maybe some land and some single family and condos. And if you may recall, we had a massive recession in the early 90s. It was exacerbated by the Resolution Trust Corporation that seized a lot of small banks and thrift and loans that were deregulated during the Reagan years in the 80s. And that caused a big spiral in the real estate market, because a lot of the lenders were seized and taken over. So things weren't selling. LA was going through some tougher times, with lost a lot of aerospace jobs. You had the fall of the Berlin Wall in the mid-90s. You had the major earthquake. So things got really bad here for a while. So I ended up really entering the, call it as a professional in real estate, doing workouts. So I joined a team through a friend of mine who introduced me to it, to work for a trust that was set up by the state of California to rehabilitate and liquidate Executive Life Insurance Company, which became the largest insurance takeover in United States history. John Garamendi, who was insurance commissioner at the time, seized the company. So I came in just really as an operative, as a consultant, to work on what was the trust. And through a series of circumstances and timing and just knowing how to execute on deals, I became the director of the entire real estate liquidation of that trust, which held nearly $1 billion of assets, as well as Executive Life failed because it was a big investor at the time in junk bonds with Drexel. And Fred Carr, the chairman, was a very big buyer of those bonds, and a lot of them were went bad during the early 90s. And so the goal was to liquidate and rehabilitate the company's assets and sell them to the highest bidder and return as much money to the policyholders and the people that, were the constituents of the insolvency.
It's fascinating. We'll come back to that, because I'm sure maybe not as bad today as it was then, but I'm sure there's some parallels in terms of, how the markets are.
Oh, it was far worse. Trust me, it was far worse. There's much more efficiencies in the market today. There's much deeper capital flows. The banks are much more solid. Yeah, it was more the Wild West then.
Yeah. What next after the trust and the liquidation? What was the next step of your career?
Basically, I worked myself out of a job.
As you do.
Yeah. Basically, all the trust assets, real estate, bonds, litigation assets were all disposed of and sent back to the appropriate beneficiaries. And at that time, my name started to get out there a little bit as someone in the local real estate community. So I was able to find a real job then. I went to work for Heitman Capital, Chicago-based firm, was a pension fund advisor, and I worked in a special situations group there in LA that was also doing workouts and dispositions, not quite as distressed, but assets that were, you know, non-essential, either for clients or directly. So I worked in dispositions and asset management of real estate for another 3 years, kind of going through the remaining period of that long stretch from the mid-90s. And in the year 2000, about 23 years ago, or 24 years ago now, I joined Kennedy Wilson, who had acquired a portion of the Heitman company. They acquired their management company, and they happened to move into the same suite in Beverly Hills that we were in. And I got to know these folks, including Bill McMorrow, the chairman of the company. And when there was nothing left to do at Heitman on the liquidation side, basically, they hired me. So I wheeled my stuff down the hall on a little dolly and moved into an office and basically started buying apartments on a one-off basis there.
Just to clarify for our listeners, there's a investment management shop in Chicago today called Heitman that's a fund manager. Is this a derivation or a prior iteration of the same organization?
Heitman, you mean the Heitman Capital Company?
That's right.
They've been around since the 60s.
Okay.
Yeah. They're one of the premier old line pension fund advisory firms in the country.
Got it. Okay. So after Heitman, you went to Kennedy Wilson.
Yeah. I mean, that was my first job as an acquisition officer. I had been an asset manager and a workout guy for, you know, 7 years. So this was the first time I got into the other side where I was really trying to produce deals and help grow that platform.
And so over the course of your time at Kennedy Wilson, were you principally involved in acquisitions, or how did your role evolve while you were there?
You know, Kennedy Wilson, it still is, but it was a very entrepreneurial firm led by Bill McMorrow, who's one of the great icons in real estate. And, you know, I was basically given the reins to, if I could raise the money and it made sense, I could start really creating a portfolio. So it really went from the business that I had from a 1Z, 2Z acquisition thing it morphed its way into a company. And so we formed Kennedy Wilson Multifamily around it, and that became a separate company within the larger Kennedy Wilson. So basically, I morphed it into a vertically integrated company and hired more people, and gave it, you know, different functions in asset management, construction management, accounting, and so forth. And basically that, like I said, grew into a pretty good sized business into what became a larger New York Stock Exchange traded real estate company.
And so it sounds like you were at Kennedy Wilson for what, 13-ish years? Is that about right?
13 and a half, yeah.
Yeah. Before you started True American, what was the impetus for kind of starting True America and leaving Kennedy Wilson and kind of going off on your own again?
Frankly, I had no need to, shall we say, leave Kennedy Wilson. Kennedy Wilson's a great company. I'm still very proud of my association with them. And Bill McMorrow is a good friend of mine, but it wasn't my company per se. And it wasn't solely dedicated to housing. It had many other businesses and still does today. So I wanted to build a company that was more national in scope in the multifamily area, and really take it to the next level. And so I had an opportunity to do that. And I partnered with an insurance company that was an investor of mine, Guardian Life Insurance. And it was really with their impetus and my desire that I made the decision, after contemplating it for a few years, to actually venture out and do that. And so we launched very humbly in June of 13 with, I don't know, $10 million of working capital and 10 people.
What did the multifamily, institutional multifamily investment landscape look like in June of 2013? I mean, today we think about your firm, True America. We think about some of the other behemoths in the space. But I imagine in 2013, the landscape was quite different.
Yeah, because people had just come off the GFC. So everybody kind of got shaken to their core. So even though we started to emerge and the transaction market started to normalize in 2010, 2011, 2012, there was still, I think, you know, it's sort of like pinch me. Could this still be going up? Are rents really going to rise? Is capital still going to flow? Because development pipeline had really shrunk over those period, intervening years leading up to and following the GFC. So it was still a questionable. I questioned myself that, geez, should I really be starting a company? And maybe we'll be back in a recession here soon. You know, so I had a lot of hesitation at the time that I had to overcome. Little did I know, we were only at the beginning of a very long positive cycle. I don't know if you remember at conferences, everybody would ask, oh, what inning are we in? Remember the inning question?
I remember the inning question.
Finally, people started saying we're in a doubleheader, or they didn't answer, you know?
Yeah, well, I think 2013 was the pregame show / the top of the first, right?
It was the top of the first. It was the pregame show. And all you had to do, if you knew what you were doing, was to buy enough real estate between, call it 2012 and the last 10 years up until 21, and you did quite well. You have to know how to manage it and all that, but still, the acquisition opportunities were the best in those 10 years that I've seen in many, many decades.
But I think you're being a bit humble as well. I mean, if we think back to the GFC, when you were wrapping up, when you were at Kennedy Wilson, starting your own business, True America, I mean, multifamily wasn't a mainstream institutional asset class. When did that kind of start to evolve in terms of institutional interest?
Very good question. So firms like Heitman and a lot of the big pension fund advisors in the 90s and so forth would buy office buildings, big retail centers and hotels, which were really the mainstream bread and butter for institutional investing. And multifamily was left to syndicators, entrepreneurs, and maybe some opportunity funds here and there. So it was really, and that's what I kind of did. I don't want to say I pioneered, but I sort of developed an institutional fundraising mechanism for apartments at Kennedy Wilson through strategic joint ventures and carried that forward into True America, only ratcheted up to another level where we are partners with at least a dozen of the top insurance companies in the world, many pension funds, and some really great names that you would recognize.
And so I think today, if I'm not mistaken, True America is in the top 25 of the NMHC, the National Multifamily Housing Council's, you know, top investment managers or owners, correct?
Yeah, we emerged to that level last year. We're ranked 25th in size in America.
And what does that look like? Give us an overview of True America's business today, size, scale, units, kind of whatever metrics are you use to describe the scope of the business.
We own and we operate just under 60,000 apartments across 17 states and about 31 MSAs in the country. We started in the West Coast where, you know, we had the greatest skill set, knowledge base, and about, I don't know, 4 years into the platform, I went east and opened up a pretty significant operation in Washington, D.C. Metro. And then we opened another operation down in Florida to really focus on the Southeast and the Eastern Seaboard all the way up to Boston. So we really built out our East Coast operation over the latter 5 years of our 10-year history. And in the last 3 years, and we were slowed down a little bit during COVID, we entered Texas and the Midwest. So we have an operation hubbed out of Dallas as well.
Why'd you choose Washington, D.C. as your first market outside of the West Coast?
So I could pilfer people that worked at Avalon. I've always wanted to be close to universities, and there's some great real estate schools there, including Georgetown. And a lot of our team are Georgetown grads. There are also great real estate companies that located in D.C. I also didn't want the cost structures of New York. I was trying to avoid what are, you know, really much higher salaries and much higher cost to operate. So I felt the Mid-Atlantic was just a good spot. Plus, I like Washington, D.C. It's a great city.
It is a great city. And so today, are you vertically integrated? Do you do your own property management or do you use third parties to handle that on your behalf?
No, we use third parties. I've been in the management business before. I had a management company when I was at Kennedy Wilson and I unwound it. I just feel like you really need a lot of scale to really be good at that business. And even though we have that scale, you may not have it in every single market you're in. And I just feel some of the bigger management companies can do a really good job. But what we do is very, very hands-on asset management. I call it the flood the zone approach. We don't just manage from a remote office. We're out in the field with the management companies. Plus, we have our own accounting group, which shadows the management company's accounting group, and we do our own construction management. So we're vertically integrated, but we don't third-party manage, and we don't manage our own assets. We use the management companies to do that for us, and they do a great job.
And so your strategy is Class B multifamily housing in the United States. And is that right, or is it more expansive than that?
Slightly more expansive, but 99% of what we do is in the Class B space. We recently entered, I guess you'd call it a version of Class A, which is new build for rent projects that we either develop or buy from home builders that we lease up. So we do that. We have owned some Class A real estate along the way, but the bread and butter of what we do is small A, affordable market rate housing for the American workforce.
So from a, you know, housing is obviously an essential need and a issue that's top of everybody's mind. I mean, what are, you know, as you look through the lens of what you're seeing in your portfolio, and then from a macro perspective, I mean, how do you think about the supply and demand, let's call it imbalance, which I think is a fact around housing in the country? And what does that mean for organizations like True America as you think about, you know, either supplying more of it or improving the quality of the stock that we already have?
Well, as I say, sometimes one size doesn't fit all. And each region, each municipality, and each state has different issues going on. California's had a net outward migration, yet you still have a massive housing shortage. The reason, particularly in Southern California and the Bay Area, it's very hard to get entitlements. It's very hard to make deals pencil because labor costs are still very high and so are materials costs. So there's still a housing shortage in California. There's a housing shortage in New York Metro. Even though they've built a lot of housing there, there's been a pretty decent influx of people moving back to the city post-COVID. If you look at Austin, Texas, there's a housing glut right now. Too much Class A housing got built. But where the common theme is among all these markets in the country is there's just not enough workforce housing to help the renter by necessity as opposed to the renter by choice. And there's certainly not enough capital A affordable housing for folks that are below the median income that are looking for quality places to live. And I think that's where you're seeing a lot of the kind of social pushback against landlords, because I guess they're, according to the media, they're the people to blame. But a lot of the problem is in local government. Local governments aren't requiring enough density or approvals to build enough housing. And that's part of the big problem in a number of areas.
And is it fair to say that in this environment, it just doesn't make economic sense to build new workforce housing? Or are there some markets where we can see kind of net new product coming online?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Typically, it's very hard to build what I'll call Class B housing. I think the build for rent space attempts to address, I'm going to call it the higher demographic cohort of that space. It still may be a renter by necessity, but as a renter by necessity, it might be paying is up to $1,000 more a month. Like our average rent is about $1,700 across every state on average, whereas that rent might be in the $2 a square foot range. When you start to push up to $3 a square foot and a much bigger number, like $2,500, you're getting into a higher household income.
You get into a higher household income. So where do you see the greatest demand for workforce housing today across the country?
I think that demand is for folks that lie between qualifying for affordable housing, maybe in that $40,000 per annual household income strata, depending on the market, and call it $60,000 to $70,000. That's the part we're not addressing, that lost middle market. There's just not enough being built. So there's a lot of housing that's bought and rehabbed. And that's what what we do. We provide a better choice for people than just old housing stock.
Interesting. And what do you think the government's role? You mentioned entitlements in some markets like Southern California and the Bay Area, but in general, what is your kind of view on the government's role in facilitating an environment where kind of more workforce and affordable housing can exist?
Yeah, that's another, what I think, very good question. It's a little bit of a difficult one because it gets very, very political. But in the higher demographic areas, you have a NIMBYism. Don't build it in my backyard. Go build it somewhere else in the city. So you can't aggregate all new housing south of downtown LA. People work all throughout the basin. So it's up to local council districts and the mayor and everybody else to set the table to allow for higher density in maybe some areas that normally wouldn't like it. And that's the only way you're going to get enough housing. And I think if you get enough Class A housing, eventually the price point starts to come down and it settles into a number that people can actually afford. But most housing that's built is Class A.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, we're in an election year. This is being recorded in February of 2024. And it'll be interesting to see how the kind of election environment or political environment impacts the policies around housing in the country. Do you have a perspective of kind of what we need more or less of?
You know, I think it's a local issue, to be honest with you. I mean, fortunately, the leaders in government did the right thing by keeping Fannie and Freddie afloat following the GFC. There was an attempt to possibly even, they took them over, but now they're making lots of money, and they really understand the difference between the single family crisis we had that was caused by derivatives and other instruments from the necessity to have a housing finance industry to support multifamily and affordable housing. So the federal government's done, I think, a good job of allocating resources to owners and developers to build or rehab housing. That's one of the strategic advantages of the United States, which then supports our workforce, our service industry, and our manufacturing industry. The bigger problem lies in state and local government. Housing is becoming more and more regulated. And what happens is the more it's regulated, the less likely it's going to be rehabbed, repositioned, or owners are going to invest in it. So that's been the challenge. What we need is more supply to create price points that people can afford.
What do you think the supply-demand imbalance is? Is there a number? We're undersupplied in the market by X number of workforce or affordable housing units, or...
Again, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. One size doesn't fit all. Each submarket, each state, each county is different. But, you know, I think we're probably undersupplied by a couple of million housing units over the next 5 years. And it's going to be even worse because there's very few new projects in the pipeline because of the sudden spike in interest rates. We do have housing that was planned years ago that's coming online last year and coming online this year. But beyond that, I think we're going to move down to a very low amount. And I think the challenge is going to be how to meet the supply needs because the United States is still growing. You've seen a lot of in-migration from south of the border. People want to live here and we have a great economy. So housing is a great way to support our economy because when you build it, it creates GDP. When people can live in it and have a choice, it creates a greater quality of life.
Yeah, I think, and that ties into my next question, which is it's more than just about housing, but it's about housing that people want to live in, that's, you know, that's clean, that's safe, that people expect. And you mentioned you don't do your own property management, but you do your own asset management. And you also use the phrase flood the zone. Can you tell me a little bit more about kind of what that means and what's the philosophy or the approach around, you know, ensuring that the tenants and the assets that you own are kind of desirable places for your community to live?
Yeah. So like I said, when we manage our properties through a very hands-on asset management approach that's regional in nature. So we're not covering Seattle from LA. We're covering Seattle and Oregon, the mountain states from Seattle. Same thing in Texas. So we have a very localized approach, which is vertically integrated with accounting and construction. So I think what creates the value for a tenant is you have an ethical landlord who is making improvements, who is making sure that all the building systems are highly operable, that the property is aesthetically pleasing, that it has amenities, and at an affordable price point, gives them a newer looking apartment with modern features that they can enjoy.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I mean, that sounds to me, you know, maybe being slightly facetious, it sounds like pie in the sky. You know, how can you have an affordable price point? How can you have all the amenities that you want? You know, are all these things kind of mutually exclusive? It sounds like they're not, right? It sounds like it is possible, but not
easy. It's a fallacy. You can absolutely do it, but you have to do it on a budget. So a renovated apartment in our portfolio doesn't need granite countertops or crown molding, but it does need quality flooring and fixturization and proper lighting and, you know, clean paint jobs. And it's nice to have a new gym and new outdoor recreation spaces and great landscaping and beautiful color schemes and package lockers and dog parks. So that's why we do everything directly to keep our costs down so we can offer price point to our customer at what we hope is still an affordable level.
Are you seeing any shifts in terms of what the customer wants in their housing units, you know, either from an amenitization perspective, a, you know, bedroom mix perspective, you know, based on some of the changes in the demographics that we've observed over the last several decades?
It really depends again on the, you know, municipality and the, is it a family area, which is going to need more two bedrooms, or is it a more urban area that you can get by with studios and ones? So I think developers have become more and more sophisticated in understanding demographics. We try to buy housing that has a good unit mix so we can offer a choice to people that want to live by themselves or they have a larger family. What's probably lacking out there that's being addressed in this build for rent movement are older millennials who are still renters by necessity or renters in the sense that they don't really want to buy a house, but they may need a larger place to live, or they want to have a dog, or they want to have, you know, they have a child, or they want to have a backyard. So they really want to live in what looks more like a house, but functions a little bit more like an apartment building.
And do you think, I mean, I think you mentioned before that you entered into the space in a small way. I mean, do you see build to rent as a kind of a long-term trend or more of a fad, or how do you look at it relative to kind of the traditional multi space?
Well, build for rent has been around for a long time, just nobody called it that. And it got that name, I think, because it was a huge movement towards single family aggregation following the great financial crisis, where Wall Street and others aggregated unconnected, disparate single family homes. Now that that's over with, can you build housing like that for rent? And the trend is to build small houses or townhomes or row houses that give people some of the amenities that a normal home would have, if not all of them.
And do you see that as synergistic or competitive to what you're doing in the multi-space?
No, it's a different price point. I think it's synergistic. It's a way to continue with the same customer. You're just offering a slightly newer and slightly bigger product.
So we're recording this. I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about the macro. We're recording this a week, I believe, after the annual NMHC conference which was in San Diego last week. Kind of what was the, I know you weren't there personally, but kind of what's your take on the macro environment for housing or residential multifamily real estate right now?
Well, Brendan, transaction activity has been at a record low. If you talk to most of the major institutional brokerage firms, I think their transactions are down as much as 70% or more. So there's been a lack of availability of product, and it's exacerbated by that the product that has listed is not meeting the market from a price point right now. Interest rates climbed, well past 6 for fixed rate mortgages. The 10 years come down into the low 4s, but you're still borrowing in the mid to high 5s. So until cap rates level up, the paradigm of getting free cash flow has kind of been, that's the joy that's been taken out of the business. When we were borrowing in the 3s and 4s and call it buying in the 5s and then growing income, you had a 200 to 300 basis point delta and properties were generating north of 8% cash flow. This still is an investment. You're investing for beneficiaries of pension funds or stockholders of insurance companies and their treasury and opportunity funds. So this is still a for-profit business.
And I think one of the things that I've been hearing a lot about is that the kind of rent growth that we've experienced, year-over-year rent growth that we've experienced running up to this period of time is largely over. How do you think that the markets have more room to run once we get past this kind of period of relative stasis, I guess, in the markets? Or are we kind of at a level point where, it's going to take quite a while for supply demand absorption to catch up and rates to expand again?
Yeah, I think you have to separate the investment world from the consumer world. And COVID really messed up the equation in the consumer world, because a lot of people were getting subsidies, a lot of people were working from home, and some were getting second places in areas that they wanted to be in but didn't necessarily need to live in all the time. So suddenly there was a huge housing demand, there was more cash in the system despite the pandemic, and rental rates just went through the roof. So, if you look at the charts, I mean, you see this real lumpiness where from 2020 through 2022, I think rents spiked almost high teens, low 20s cumulatively over that period of time. That's not normal. Rents have typically gone up on an inflationary basis between 3 and 5% a year. Value add landlords like myself are buying apartments that are typically under rented. So that's why we have the incentive to rehab, and we mark to market after we rehab, but we're not raising rents again, 19 or 20%. So things are normalized. So people have got to get used to that. There has been some, what I'll call gain to lease or a reduction of asking rents, but that's a reflection of the spike that was achieved during COVID. So I think all that's going to normalize in the next 12 to 18 months and it will be back to a more of a steady stasis of growth.
So what does that mean for groups like yours, True America, and others who are owners and investment managers and fiduciaries where, the days of the ZIRP days are over, it's going to be harder to make assets pencil, rent growth is going to be more moderated than it has been. How do you create the value in these assets that make them attractive investments for you to buy and own?
Well, as I say, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. So it requires really good research, really good underwriting, really understanding what the market in that particular submarket or property or neighborhood can absorb and whether people can afford it. So it requires a lot of detailing and also being able to control expenditures. Right now, one of the headwinds in the apartment business is the cost of insurance. And that's really taken the joy out of a lot of markets, particularly Florida. So it's all about containment of costs and being able to do a measured, you know, leveling of rent over a period of time that's longer term than relying on some 20% spike that was really not real 4 years ago.
Yeah. You mentioned insurance. It's interesting. It comes up in a lot of the institutional conversations that I have. And it seems like for the first time, at least in my career, insurance premiums are actually impacting the ability to transact and to make money. Maybe can you elaborate a little bit more on what you're seeing? Kind of where are rates going up? Why do you think that they're going up? For somebody who doesn't understand this phenomena and how it impacts the NOI of an asset, kind of how would you explain it at a 101 level?
Well, normally in better times, insurance was kind of a non-issue. You know, it would cost somewhere between, call it $200 and $400 a unit per year. Okay. And now it costs $1,000 per unit per year. And in Florida, it might cost $2,000 a unit per year. So insurance has really gone up in almost all markets, particularly ones that have had environmental issues. You know, the insurance industry has suffered a lot of losses during the hurricanes and, you know, things that went on and tornadoes and so forth. So a lot of environmental risk that they took. And so unfortunately, that's now being actuarialized, if there's such a word, back to the owner. So it's no different than a big co-op or consortium. So we're paying back in premium what the insurance companies have put out. Starting to see some normalization, but I think it's going to take a while where the insurance industry has to not experience, you know, above predictable losses.
Does that make certain markets potentially uninvestable going forward?
It certainly can. I think buildings in Florida that are not concrete block or built in the most highest way possible, you know, wood frame buildings or buildings in lowlands, those are going to be tough to transact because of insurance costs.
Yeah.
Particularly with higher interest rates.
It's kind of the double whammy.
You're getting hit on both ends. Not to mention, in a no income tax states like Florida and Texas, your property taxes are quite high. So if your expenses are going up, you know, a lot, you're already paying 50% of your net income or your net cash flow and expenses, it's hard. You're not going to transfer all that back to the resident.
It's interesting. And how does that translate into your kind of sustainability practices, if any? I mean, I think, you know, where you buy is obviously part of the equation and does it make money is the biggest part. But, you know, besides insurance, kind of what else are you thinking about from a sustainability perspective?
So because we rehab, we're not LEED certified or anything, but we do pay attention and we have been long before the term ESG started. We've always used energy saving appliances, water saving devices in the faucet tree area of an apartment. We've gone to drip irrigation and zero scaping long before it was popular, particularly in I'll call it the desert regions or other areas that have high water costs or lack of water. So we're pretty in tune with it. We have added solar where we can. So we try to do the best job we can to be environmentally resilient, Nest thermostats, and try to use technology wherever possible.
You know, you've been in this business for, I think you said 4 decades now, and, you know, you've been through kind of many market cycles. You mentioned this one is nothing or a lot less hectic than the RTC cycle. How does it compare to kind of other periods of time? You know, if somebody's listening to this where they entered the business in 2013, everything's been up and to the right, and all of a sudden, bam, smacks you in your face, we're in a different environment. What advice would you give to people who are, you know, the many people who are sitting in that exact position today?
Well, unfortunately, you're giving the advice after the fact, because where a lot of the damage is going to occur and the why people are saying there's a wall of maturity is coming and all that negative talk that you hear is because a lot of people that entered the business, call it from the last 5 to 6 years, probably weren't regulating, you know, the hedging cost of a variable rate debt. They never expected to have what the lenders have and all these debt coverage ratio tests and maturity tests and renewal of hedges. So if you're over leveraged or using synthetic equity like preferred or mezzanine and your debt's coming due or there's a rebalancing issue, you could be in trouble if you can't write a check or your investors aren't willing to write a check. So that's where a lot of the stress will come from, the over leveraged, undercapitalized investor. And we're just talking about the apartment market. We're not talking about office. That's a whole nother problem. Because the consumer side of our business is stable. The American renter is stable. The American renter is making more household income than it made 5 years ago. And we have a pretty good system going. Now, sure, there's regulatory headwinds and sure, there's other issues. But we're fortunate in multifamily because we have a good supply-demand balance and, you know, people have to live somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, the headlines have been littered with some of these stories of, you know, groups who are kind of being caught when the tide goes out, no pun intended. You know, are you seeing distressed deals come your way or do you think that's still on the come?
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of it. And the stuff that I've seen is not quality real estate. We buy quality real estate. I have seen, and you always will see, what I call a time's up situation, where a deal could be properly capitalized, has an institutional partner and an entrepreneurial sponsor, but the institutional partner says, okay, it's been 5 years, I want to sell, I need to sell. Now, not everybody does that, and that may be a hard pill to swallow for the sponsor on the other end of the deal, because they don't want to sell, particularly into a bad market. So that's where I think there's been some opportunities in these so-called times up situations.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting nuance of our business, holding, you know, illiquid assets and closed end vehicles with finite investment periods.
There's no permanent capital. I mean, maybe in the Odyssey funds, but in what we do, it's terminal capital. It has a shelf life to it. Most people want it back.
So what are you looking at over the next 12 to 18 months? What's interesting to you given where we are in the markets today?
Yeah. We love our space. We're taking a cautiously optimistic approach to it. What's interesting to me right now is really managing your portfolio for durability, cash flow, and cost reduction. In addition to that, we're branching out a little bit. We're going into the capital A affordable housing space. We're working on some things there to allow us to enter that space. We do like to build for rent space, although it has had some headwinds recently because of interest rates and financing. We still like that space. So we're kind of sticking with our knitting with a few enhancements.
And are there specific markets that you're not in today that you'd like to be in, or markets you are in today that you're likely going to move out of over the next, you know, several quarters?
You know, there's been a real rise, Brandon, of America's secondary and tertiary cities to be, you know, great places to invest in that maybe weren't on the institutional radar 5 years ago. We'll invest in Tacoma, Washington, in addition to Seattle. We'll invest in Miami, but we'll also invest in Fort Myers. We'll invest in Raleigh-Durham, and we'll also invest in Asheville. So Spartanburg, South Carolina. So I think there's a strong impetus due to both affordability and work from home on suburban housing.
If there was one thing that kept you up at night from a professional perspective, whether it's something you can control or you can't control, kind of what's that nagging thing that keeps you up at night?
Well, I do sleep pretty well, but I guess probably the biggest challenge right now is interest rates. You know, are interest rates going to normalize along with cap rates so we get back to a normal stasis in the market? So how do you grow your business if you can't buy and you can't sell? You're basically staying in place, and that may be fine for a private owner, but not for a company that's actively in the business of trading real estate and buying and selling and rehabbing it.
And what is your outlook for interest rates in 2024 and 2025?
I think what I've seen thus far is I think the Fed's going to hold the line on higher for longer. Whether that carries forward into the new election cycle, we'll see. But I think they've got their, even though inflation's down about 3%, they don't want to have the Paul Volcker effect where he dropped interest rates too soon and they went back up. So I think there's a real caution there that is still present in the interest rate market. But I think it could loosen up a little bit in a couple more quarters. But I don't know if it's going to be material.
Is the higher for longer okay as long as it stays relatively normal, or does it really need to come down? I mean, what must give, right? Is it interest rate normalization, or is it a decrease in rates, or is it kind of sellers being willing to transact at what they perceive to be the new normal?
It's the latter of what you said. I mean, you need sellers to be willing to transact that were previously selling at a 4 cap may have to sell at a 6 cap. So you still have people buying on the margin where they're buying based on growth. So they're buying well below that 6 cap. They're buying in the 5 still, even though their borrowing rate creates what we call negative leverage. But typically, well-managed institutions do not want to buy with negative leverage. Negative leverage was a common thing 25 years ago when rates were much higher. And it's not that cap rates were equally high, but people accepted that more. In today's environment, people don't accept that as much. It's not something institutions look favorably on.
I think it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next 6 to 12 months here. The market certainly is an interesting place. Before I let you go, Bob, you are very humble. You've had an incredible career. You've built an incredible business. You've also done a lot to give back. I mean, tell us a little bit on the personal side. You're involved with a lot of different organizations. Kind of what are you involved with, and why do you do that? You've obviously got a business to run. You're a fiduciary, yet you still kind of find and make the time to be very active philanthropically and in the communities that you serve.
Thank you. You know what? It's I enjoy it. That's the bottom line. I've been always involved, even as a teenager, in some form of community service. And so I just carried that forward into my adult life and my adult work career. And now it's become more philanthropy, whether it's raising money for homeless causes or for cancer research or for other areas of, you know, social service. I enjoy that. I enjoy enlarging the industry I'm in to join me in that pursuit. And I try to create mentor type relationships with folks that will also get involved. So to me, it's an extension of what I do in business.
Of all the things that you're focused on, is there one particular cause or initiative or organization that you're kind of more focused on this year as a priority than you have been in the past?
Well, the organization that I've been focused on for the last 2 decades is an organization that does really God's work. It's called Chrysalis. They help people that are emerging from homelessness, particularly in LA and the surrounding counties, to help them find meaningful work through training and placement. So I've been involved with Chrysalis now for 2 decades and have consistently been involved in their fundraising efforts, and I serve on their board. So that's probably my number one philanthropic passion. I'm on a couple of boards of trustees of educational institutions, including my alma mater, WPI, and I'm involved with the City of Hope, which is a cancer research center here in Los Angeles, among other things.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate community service and the service to the community. And Bob, if anybody wants to learn more about True America, get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, they can always go on our website, www.trueamerica.com, or they can call me.
Good old-fashioned pick up the telephone. Turns out it still works sometimes, huh?
I do. I take calls, you know, or email me, rhart@trueamerica.com. Happy to do whatever I can, provided I have the time at the moment or if they can wait. So, but I'm always happy to help.
As always, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Thanks for your candor, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, Brandon. Good to see you. Bye, friend. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter at B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.